Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. This is the 150th anniversary of some of the pivotal moments in the Civil War. And Ball State University has a fascinating new exhibit, the Frank A. Bracken U.S. Civil War Collection in Bracken Library. He's a former trustee with deep family ties to the university. The collection includes artifacts, photos, weapons, reenactment uniforms authentic to the period, and more than 300 academic and rare books about the war and President Abraham Lincoln. Some of the material belonged to Bracken's great-grandfather, William Halsworth Bracken, who served as a first lieutenant in the Indiana Cavalry during the war. Among those at the opening this month was history professor Nicole Etchison, author of several books on the Civil War. She gave a presentation titled The Goodly Land of Hoosier, How the Civil War Changed Indiana, and we talked with her later on the second floor of the library, sitting among some of the artifacts in the collection.
If you travel to Tennessee, there's one battlefield after another. Mm-hmm. But Indiana in the Civil War, did we have anything to do with it?
Well, I like to say that the Midwesterners won the Civil War. Lincoln is from Indiana and Illinois. Grant and Sherman are from Ohio originally, and then Grant resettles in Illinois. If you look at the early part of the war, the generals that Lincoln turns to, George McClellan, who's from New Jersey, George Meade from Pennsylvania, Joe Hooker is also a New Englander, they are the generals who failed. And it's not until Lincoln turns to the Midwesterners that the war begins to turn around for the Union. Indiana does not have many battlefields. Morgan's Raid is the main military event in Indiana, and it's relatively minor in the context of the war.
What happened there, by the way?
Well, John Hunt Morgan is a Confederate cavalry commander from Kentucky, and what he was supposed to do in the summer of 1863 was provide a diversionary raid into Kentucky to distract Union forces in Tennessee from what the main Confederate army was doing there. And he went off, he raided through Kentucky, but then he went into Indiana and Ohio before the bulk of his forces were captured trying to recross the Ohio River back into Kentucky. One of the reasons that Morgan makes this raid is that the lower Midwestern states, Ohio, Indiana, had a lot of Kentucky settlers. Very large portion of the population in Indiana had parents who had been born in Kentucky or North Carolina or Virginia, or maybe they themselves had been born in Kentucky and the family had migrated to Indiana. So there was a lot of dissent in Indiana about the war. And the Republicans in Indiana particularly played that up, that Democrats in Indiana weren't necessarily loyal to the Union cause. And so Morgan may have thought that if he raided into southern Indiana and Ohio, people would rise up and support him, and they didn't.
Where did he cross the river?
He crosses the eastern part of the state,
okay,
near Corydon. What Morgan's force did is they captured a steamboat and ferried across. They came under some fire doing this, but they managed to get successfully across. And some of them were able to ride their horses across. And the Indiana Legion, which was the local militia, rallied to stop them. They were raiding through the southeastern part of the state. And the Legion put up defenses at Corydon. Morgan's raiders are veteran Confederates. They've been in many battles. By July of 1863, the Indiana Legion at Corydon has no military experience. A lot of them mustered in response to the governor's call that the state had been invaded. And they were quickly overrun. But what's happening at the same time is that the regular U.S. Army is rallying its forces and moving to chase Morgan down. And when that begins to happen, then he turns south when he's in Ohio to try and escape. Some people make fun of the Indiana Legion, its performance at Corydon and during Morgan's raid, but other historians give them credit for slowing Morgan down, so making it possible for the regular U.S. forces to catch up with him.
So if you're a tourist in Indianapolis and you go to the State House, there on the, I think, the eastern steps is a statue to Governor Morton.
Morton earned the name the Soldier's Friend. And he's not the only Union governor who gets called the Soldier's Friend, but he's one of them. And he took very particular care of Indiana soldiers. Because even if there aren't very many battlefields in Indiana, Indiana has one of the highest percentages of its military age population serve in the Union Army. So there are Indiana soldiers with Sherman at Atlanta, there are Indiana soldiers in the Petersburg campaign with Grant, there have been Indiana soldiers fighting in almost every battlefield of the war. In fact, in the spring of 1865, the last Union soldier to die in the war is a Hoosier, and it's out in a small skirmish in Texas that took place after Lee had surrendered. So Indiana soldiers are serving in very, very large numbers, and Morton wanted to make sure that they were supplied, that they got medical care. During the Civil War, the War Department is, of course, providing services for the Army, but we went from a very tiny military force to a million-man army in a very short time. So the states were trying to fill in these gaps, making sure that their men were supplied. So, for example, after the Battle of Shiloh, or the battles at Henry and Donelson, where Indiana troops had been involved, Morton would appeal to the people of Indiana to send packages. We need bandages for the soldiers, for the Indiana soldiers, and he would make sure these went to Indiana troops. The downside was he's not going to share with the Illinoisans or the Pennsylvanians. He wants these for the Hoosier troops. And he went to hospitals, and he talked to soldiers. So that's why he becomes the Soldier's Friend, because he is known to be looking out for them.
What do we have here in this collection? What are the things not to miss here?
It's an excellent collection. I think you have some examples of Civil War uniforms. You have his ancestors' sword. You have some artifacts from the Civil War, which are always wonderful for people to see, and especially having it here at Ball State, students can come and see this and get a real tactile sense of what it would be like to wear this wool uniform in July in around Atlanta. There are also a large collection of papers about battlefield preservation. Frank Bracken was very interested in historic preservation and battlefield preservation. That was a major cause for him, and so got a lot of papers. And we do have graduate programs here in historic preservation, so I think that will be very interesting.
Nicole Etchison, Ball State history professor and author of the book A Generation at War, The Civil War Era in a Northern Community, about the effect of the war in one community, Putnam County, Indiana.
Civil War skeletons in their graves. They came up clapping in the spirit of the aviator.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com.
So when we see these wool uniforms, it makes you think of the conditions that these folks lived in. For instance, there were many casualties from illness,
yes.
Right? Can you paint a picture for us of the life of soldiers in this time?
Well, we are now upping the numbers. People are doing very careful studies of muster rolls and censuses and the casualty statistics. And so we now think that the number of men who died in the Civil War is closer to 700,000 or more than the old 500,000, 600,000. We don't have any idea how many civilians died, and a lot of them did. So a lot of refugees in the South and civilian casualties who are caught in crossfire during battles. For the men who go into the Army, One of the first phenomenon is getting rid of all the things you brought with you that you thought you were going to carry around. Books. They will divest themselves of anything but perhaps a small testament, a memorandum book in which they write little notes or keep a journal. The soldiers often had what was called a housewife, which is a little kit in which you might have a needle and some sewing device. You've got your canteen. You may have a skillet or something you can set on a fire to cook your bacon, and the food, of course, is miserable. They have canned food. This is a period when canned food is coming into popularity for the Army. They have hardtack, which is a kind of bread that you bake it at a very low temperature for like 24 hours, a very long time. And then to eat it, what the soldiers would do is you break off a part, you use the butt of your rifle to smash it down, and then you mix it with the bacon grease and eat it. They eat a lot of cornmeal products, corn bread or corn pone, or you make a kind of a batter out of cornmeal and water and stick it on your bayonet and hold it in the fire to cook it. So the food can be pretty bad. They do get care packages from home, which they are always enthusiastic about. Wives are packing up butter and apples. Those are very popular items. Baked turkeys, roasted turkeys, baked hams, these things might be sent. Cakes, pies, jellies. They'll get those kinds of luxuries either from care packages from organizations, for example, that Governor Morton has mustered out, or from family members. A lot of this goes to waste. A lot of it spoils before it actually gets to the soldiers. You march.
I was going to say, this is an army on its feet. We
yes.
think of, the 1800s as a time when horses were used for transportation, but generally not for these people. They are marching.
Regular infantry soldiers, you have to march 20 miles a day carrying a pack. And you might have in that pack whatever extra socks, whatever kit that you've got, a kind of rubberized tarp if it rains that you can throw over. And it can be fairly heavy, which is why at the beginning of the war they're sort of lightening these. And a lot of times after a battle, an army that's straggling or has been defeated, people are dropping things. This is actually one of the ways that Civil War generals try to gauge after a battle whether the other side is giving up. If there's a lot of stuff scattered around, you make the assessment, oh, they're failing, they're on the run, and maybe if I hit them again, I can prevail. Sometimes those judgments turn out to be wrong, and the men actually do form up and hold steady. But yes, long marches in all kinds of weather. The roads, of course, are largely dirt. So the soldiers are marching in dust if it's dry, and mud if it's not. These old Civil War jokes about it was so muddy the mules sank down to their ears. And what is in wagons or being hauled by mules and horses often gets stuck. One of the reasons the campaigns are largely in the summer is you have to wait for the roads to dry before you can haul cannon or haul equipment, as the wagons will just get stuck in all this mud.
Some of the most fascinating personalities were these generals. What distinguished the superb generals from those who fell by the wayside?
Probably the main distinction, we all know that Lincoln goes through a lot of generals before he gets to Grant. Some of them, like Ambrose Burnside, were probably promoted beyond their capabilities. And the remark that Ulysses Grant makes about Burnside is that Burnside knew he wasn't capable of commanding an army, but Lincoln didn't have anybody else. Some people, John Pope, Joe Hooker, were just overreachingly arrogant and overestimated what they can do and underestimated Robert E. Lee. The big distinction, I think, on the Union side is between George McClellan, who takes command early in the war, and McClellan is someone who has never failed at anything. He was top of the class at West Point. He was chosen by the Army to go to the Crimea when there was a war there in the 1850s, as an observer and report back new battlefield innovations to the Army. He left the Army in the 1850s because he was courting a general's daughter, and General Marcy told his daughter, don't marry a soldier. Your mother will tell you, a soldier's life, so the life of a soldier's wife, you don't want that. So McClellan left the Army and he became a railroad corporate president by his early 30s. So this man has always been successful. And what seems to happen in 1862 when he's commanding the Union Army is that he cannot take a risk because he might fail. And he doesn't know how to deal with failure. That, of course, contrasts enormously with Ulysses Grant, who was okay at West Point and excelled at mathematics and horsemanship, who played a minor role during the war with Mexico, but was not a leading figure, and who basically got drummed out of the Army for drunkenness in the early 1850s, and he can't make a go of it really in civilian life. He's peddling firewood on the streets of St. Louis to buy his children Christmas presents. But then when he comes back into the Army during the Civil War, he's failed, and he knows you can pick yourself up, you can dust yourself off, and you can go back at it. And that is what he does over and over again. Shiloh in the spring of 1862, he nearly gets beaten. The Confederates thought they had won that battle, and on the second day, Grant is still there, and he hits back. At Vicksburg was very long and very difficult, but he ultimately prevailed. And then in the campaign against Robert E. Lee, who truly is a military genius, one of the greatest military minds the U.S. has produced, everybody else who's gone up against Lee has gotten thoroughly whipped. And Grant, he hits Lee, and everybody, and it doesn't work, and everybody expects Grant to give up, as McClellan did, and Grant just hits again. And he just has this bulldog tenacity, and I think it has to do with knowing you can come back from a failure and keep going.
Ball State history professor Nicole Etchison, whose work includes research into the effect of the Civil War on Northern communities. We talked with her as the school opened a new exhibit, the Frank A. Bracken U.S. Civil War Collection in Bracken Library. The collection includes artifacts, photos, weapons, reenactment uniforms, and other materials. You can see it in room 210 of the library in the Archives and Special Collections area.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
We have such a record of people's letters and journals and things of that sort. Are there people that, as we're looking back to Indiana's role, that have come to your attention?
Yes. Well, I don't want to start up interstate jealousy. The Ohioans performed normally, nobly, the Pennsylvanians did. I don't want to slight any of the Union states, but Indiana made its contributions. And one of our key contributions, actually, one of the most important battles of the war, is the Battle of Antietam, September 1862. September 17th, it is actually the bloodiest day in U.S. history. More Americans died on September 17th than died on September 11th, 2001. More died at Antietam than died on D-Day. It is still to date the single bloodiest day in our history. About 5,000 men were killed at that battle. Before the battle, the lead up to the Battle of Antietam, Robert E. Lee had invaded Maryland. It's a slave state, but it's still being held by the Union. And Confederates hoped to liberate Maryland, bring it into the Confederacy. They hoped to have a successful campaign that would encourage the British to recognize and aid the Confederacy. They hoped that a successful campaign in Maryland would affect the fall elections in the North and turn it towards anti-war candidates winning. When Lee's army invades Maryland, the Union Army's kind of in disarray, and they don't even know where he is. He's split up his army. It's in various different places. So the Union Army is out, and they are searching for Lee. The 27th Indiana camps in a field in Maryland while the search is going on, and a corporal from Indiana finds a pack of cigars. And the pack of cigars is wrapped in a piece of paper. And first, he's just thrilled he's got these cigars. But then he looks at the paper, and it is orders for the Confederate Army. These are known to Civil War historians as the Lost Orders of Antietam. He gives it to his sergeant, a man by the name of John Bloss, who is buried here in Muncie, Indiana. The sergeant sends it up the chain. It gets to General McClellan. McClellan now has orders that outline where Lee's army is. And this shows you something about McClellan. He could have exploited this more effectively. He should have moved quickly, gotten his army together, gone after Lee. It took McClellan 2 or 3 days to decide what he was going to do, by which time Lee has found out the orders are missing and is frantically reassembling his forces. And then they meet at the Battle of Antietam. McClellan attacks. It's this bloody battle. And McClellan does not succeed in annihilating Lee's army, which might at that point have ended the war. But he certainly deals it a severe blow. The invasion of Maryland is over with. Lee has to limp back into Virginia. And it's considered a major Union victory and a turning point of the war. And one of the ways in which Antietam is a turning point in the war is that it's after Antietam that Lincoln decides, okay, now we have a significant Union victory. I will issue an announcement that if the Confederates don't come back into the Union, slaves are going to be emancipated. So it's a turning point because we move decisively towards making it a war to free the slaves. And Indiana soldiers played a role in bringing about that victory.
Nicole Etchison is the Alexander M. Bracken Professor of History at Ball State University and author of several books on the Civil War. We had the chance to talk with her after she gave a presentation on how the Civil War changed Indiana. Ball State has a fascinating new exhibit, the Frank A. Bracken U.S. Civil War Collection in Bracken Library. It's especially timely as the nation marks the 150th anniversary of some of the pivotal moments in the Civil War this year and next, recalling the events of 1864 and 1865. You can see the new Civil War collection on the library's second floor in the Archives and Special Collections. There are also some terrific resources online. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture of Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from FlexSteel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.